The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Acute and Chronic Leukemia is presented by Dr. Cheryl Kowalski.
So start with lymphoma. So this is a solid, usually, malignancy. And just the tissue's gone crazy, usually from a malignant clone. So it's really important that we know what kind of lymphoma it is, because there's different treatments for each one. And so the WHO in 2016 identified 93 different types. So the two categories that we have is Hodgkin's and all the rest. So that's the non-Hodgkin lymphoma. So let's start with non-Hodgkin. We'll just talk briefly about the most common ones that we see, which is probably 10 or 11 of the most of those 93. So we have the low grade that you think about. These are just kind of ones that kind of progress along. It's generally considered incurable, usually seen in older people. And these lymph nodes can come and go. And if it's untreated, usually survival is many, many years. And usually the first approach to this is observation. The next is aggressive category. So this used to be known as intermediate, but they realized that there's a little bit more aggressive nature to these. And so the most common one you may see in your patient population we see is diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Usually it's a mass that's been enlarging. They may or may not have those B symptoms. And survival, if untreated, is generally considered to be months. And then move to the highly aggressive. So anything that you hear with the word blastic, immunoblastic, lymphoblastic, and Burkitt's, those are highly aggressive. It's a rapidly enlarging mass. And survival of untreated disease is usually just weeks. So when we do the diagnosis, we really need a lot of tissue. A fine needle aspirate is inadequate. So if you see that on a board question, that's wrong. That is not what we need. We need at least a core, and preferably if you can get at it, we need the whole lymph node. But many times that's not possible. So working them up, we usually get the routine lab that includes an LDH and a beta 2 microglobulin. In these patients, we need to get contrasted CAT scans if at all possible. I know there's people, some of our patients have renal insufficiency, and that makes it a little bit more challenged, but they need to be contrasted. And a PET scan. So a PET scan generally comes with a CAT scan, but that CAT scan is non-contrasted. So it's really important because the CAT scans really give us the size of the lymph nodes, while the PET scan just kind of lights up where there's some increased activity. These patients generally have a bone marrow biopsy, and if they have a more aggressive lymphoma that has a tendency to go to the CNS, then they would need a CSF evaluation. You may see in the evaluation of these patients by their CAT scans, especially with the follow-up CAT scan, and this is most important in Hodgkin's lymphoma, this Deauville scale. Deauville's just the town in France that it was developed, and this kind of tells what kind of response they had to chemotherapy, which is very important in Hodgkin's in the treatment. So Ann Arbor classification for staging has been around for decades. So stage 1 through 4, so 1 is just one lymph node mass. 2 is 2 lymph node masses, or you may have some extra lymphatic disease as well as adenopathy, but it's on the same side of the diaphragm. Stage 3 means that now you've gone to both sides of the diaphragm, and stage 4 means that you have more extensive disease. If there's bone marrow involvement, it's automatically considered stage 4 disease. The B symptoms are A, asymptomatic, and B doesn't stand for any particular word, it's just not A. So those are the classic fever, night sweats, and unexplained weight loss of 10% or more of the body weight in the past 6 months. And now in our staging, we only use B symptoms for Hodgkin's lymphoma. That's for staging purposes. You can use them, you know, when you're talking about the patient and their symptoms for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, but we don't use that in the staging of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So treatment for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, our cornerstone has come with Rituxan, which we've been using for at least 15 years. And that's for any lymphoma that's CD20 positive. And not all non-Hodgkin's lymphoma are, but if they're a B-cell lymphoma, usually they do have they are CD20 positive. Some other medications you may see in use in the low grade, you may also see bendamustine, a combination of drugs CVP, which is Cytoxan, Vincristine, Prednisone, CHOP, where the H stands for Adriamycin, and the O stands for Vincristine or Oncovin. And the aggressive, such as diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, R-CHOP is our cornerstone of treatment for this disease. And then in the highly aggressive, you may see hyper-CVAD, high-dose methotrexate. There's other regimens, EPOC, just so you're kind of familiar with that. The highly aggressive gets a very aggressive chemotherapy regimen. Many times they need to be put in the hospital for hydration, although we're trying to get away from automatically putting patients in the hospital for chemotherapy and trying to do as much as we can in our outpatient infusion centers. Hodgkin's disease is 1% of the malignancies in the United States. And the important thing here is this was the first disease that was shown to have potential cure by combining chemotherapy regimens. So we think about it in young people, but there was also a bimodal increase in the 70s in older people, and those are harder to treat. There can be an association with Epstein-Barr virus, but just because you have Epstein-Barr virus doesn't mean that you're automatically going to get Hodgkin's, and just because you have Hodgkin's doesn't mean that you have Epstein-Barr virus history. So let me just go back that one. So it arises from B lymphocytes, but these B lymphocytes don't have that CD20 positive, and so they don't get Rituxan, with one exception we'll talk about. So this is that Reed-Sternberg cell. It's really a cute cell, and it looks like the owl eyes. So this is diagnostic of Hodgkin's lymphoma, but you don't have to have that to make the diagnosis. So usually these lymph nodes are painless and kind of rubbery in feeling. It's the most common etiology of a mediastinal mass in a young person. And they have unusual symptoms. So they have pruritus, especially after a hot shower. If they're consuming any alcoholic beverages, they may have pain in that lymph node mass that's involved. They can have the fever and sweats that we call the B symptoms, but this Pell-Epstein fever that you may have heard of is very, very rare, and that's kind of like an intermittent fever. So there's 5 categories of Hodgkin's. So you may have heard of the lymphocyte predominant and lymphocyte depleted, nodular sclerosis, and mixed cellularity, but there's one that stands out by itself, and that's nodular lymphocyte predominant. That's kind of a crossover between Hodgkin's and non-Hodgkin's. This one can be CD20 positive. They thought about reclassifying it into a non-Hodgkin's, but they haven't done that yet. It's most commonly seen in young men, and it's more of a slower growing type of lymphoma, but fairly easy to treat, and with as good response rate as the Hodgkin lymphoma. So poor prognostic factors, of course, is the same with any malignancy, advanced stage, a large mediastinal mass, the B symptoms, if you have extranodal disease, advanced age, and for if you're a male. So it's very important for staging on these patients because if they're more favorable, they would get less chemotherapy and less radiation and therefore less problems with long-term side effects. And bone marrow transplant is usually considered after the first relapse. The standard regimen is ABVD, that's Adriamycin, Bleomycin, Vinblastine, and Dacarbazine. So late-term side effects. So with mantle radiation, that's across the clavicle and down the mediastinum, which isn't done that much anymore, is a hypothyroid, heart disease, lung, and breast cancer. And if they do the inverted Y, which is down below the diaphragm into the groin, which also is not done much anymore, is gastric cancer. And then the old regimen that was traditionally used, which was also curative, had marked increased risk for acute leukemia, and pretty much everyone was sterile after that. While with ABVD, they're able to maintain their fertility. The importance of long-term side effects is the vast majority of these people are young people. And so they have the potential life of 50, 60, 70 years, maybe 80 years after their diagnosis. And we want to minimize the treatment they get, yet not minimize it so much that they lose their potential for cure, but not have the long-term side effects that are real issues with heart disease. Usually if they have radiation to their chest and about 20 years later they have heart disease and need bypass surgery. It's a real risk to develop breast cancer in these patients as well. And so it's a tightrope that we walk trying to treat these patients to make sure that we're treating them adequately yet not giving them the higher risk of long-term side effects. So, and this is why we do what we do. When we have these patients for potential of cure, when you look down at that stage 4B and they still have a 60% long-term survival, and that can include CNS disease, that makes us as oncologists continue to do what we do. I know I've been asked many times, why do you do what you do? It's so depressing. But when you look at statistics like this, where other malignancies are also coming into this area as well with long-term survival, it is so rewarding to be able to help these patients. So we'll move over to leukemia. And so leukemia is, again, just a uncontrolled growth of a clone of cells in the bone marrow. So we have four different categories. We have the acute and the chronic. And under acute, we have lymphocytic and non-lymphocytic. And into the chronic, lymphocytic, and myelogenous. Now, you might say, well, why are you calling it non-lymphocytic, and why aren't you calling it acute myelogenous? Which you can, but there's about at least seven different categories that I'll show you in a second that have nothing to do with myelogenous. And so acute non-lymphocytic is an appropriate classification. So let's go into acute leukemia first. So these patients have this clonal proliferation of cells. It not only starts growing on its own, it takes over the bone marrow and inhibits the other good cell lines from populating. So acute means exactly that. The symptoms usually are a few weeks in duration. However, if they've arisen from another bone marrow problem, it could be a few months that you can see that evolution. And the symptoms reflect bone marrow failure, so the red cells are not making, the erythrocyte line is not populating, so the vast majority of these patients present with anemia. And then you can see thrombocytopenia, but Usually you may have some bruising, but generally not a lot of bleeding or hemorrhage. And then a big thing is fatigue. These patients really have this progressive fatigue. So if you already have one bone marrow issue going on, say myelodysplasia, and they're getting more and more tired, that's a clue that something might be going on with those patients. And bone pain is a big issue too. So acute lymphocytic leukemia, as you know, usually occurs in children, but all these malignancies, whether it's leukemia or lymphoma, can occur in any age. So the older a person gets with this disease, the worse the prognosis. Sometimes they can have the Philadelphia chromosome, and as you know, that's the most commonly seen in chronic myelogenous leukemia, which we'll talk about in a little bit. So usually their white count's going to be greater than 30,000. It's rarely seen in the black population. So predisposing factors are irradiation early in life, and then ataxia telangiectasia, mongolism, leukemia in the family, if identical twin has it. So this is the classification. You don't need to know that. Just know that there's three categories. The first one is what's usually seen in the children, and then the L2 and 3 is usually seen in older people. So because it's involving the lymph system, many times you can see adenopathy and splenomegaly with these patients. These patients can also have mediastinal masses. Usually that's seen with a T-cell ALL. And that you can see CNS involvement, although that's not real common, but it has to be looked for. And it likes to go hide in sanctuaries such as the testes, the retina, skin, and pretty much any organ can be infiltrated. So this are the different categories. So the CALL, the common ALL, is the most commonly seen in children. You can have infiltration like in the gum, mediastinum. And then the T-cell ALL is seen in a little bit older people. This is the one that usually has the mediastinal mass as well as CNS involvement. And then there is more rarely the B-cell ALL, which doesn't respond to conventional chemotherapy as well. And if they're pH positive, they'll have shorter remissions. So good prognostic feature, younger age, best if it's 3 to 9, a lower white count if your blast is lower. So you just think about heavy tumor burden is going to be worse. And then absence of any translocation, but presence of the hyperdiploid state is good. And CALA positive, which is the younger, the children usually, and female. So diagnosis is usually see blasts on the smear, but they can be confused with myeloblasts. And it's really important to distinguish the two because it's two different treatments, and that's why it's divided into two different categories. So this is where flow cytometry comes in handy. And also, again, evaluate the CSF. So this has been the common treatment for this disease for years with daunorubicin. That's not doxorubicin, which is adriamycin. It's its sister drug. Vincristine and corticosteroids. And usually they're on treatment for at least 2 years. They will have CNS prophylaxis. And if they are pH positive, you'll add imatinib. If they have really bulky mediastinal disease, they may need radiation. And if they have poor features or progression on traditional treatment, then they would be considered for transplant. So moving over to the non-lymphocytic leukemia, again, it's a malignant clone that starts and starts proliferating throughout the bone marrow. And again, very important to distinguish from ALL. And while it's more common in adults, you can see this in children as well. So this is the classification. So M1 through M7. So if you look down at M5, 6, and 7, they have nothing to do with myeloid cell line. And so that's why I use the non-lymphocytic leukemia, because you can have monocytic leukemia, acute erythroleukemia, which is affecting your erythroid line, and the acute megakaryocytic leukemia. It also affects the myeloid line to a certain extent, but generally these are the malignant clones. So etiologies of this can be ionizing radiation or exposure to chemicals. Benzene is a big deal. It's used in the production of fuel. And so there's been a lot of people in that industry that are exposed to it and have developed bone marrow issues down the road. And then exposure to alkylating agents and topoisomerase. So it's our chemotherapy drugs. And so patients who have received these down the road can have increased risk of leukemia. And then the genetic factors that you think about. And then predisposing bone marrow issues such as myelofibrosis, polycythemia, chronic granulocytopenia, and I forgot I left off myelodysplasia. Oh, I do have myelodysplasia. And then, so the prognostic factors, if they're older than 60, it's harder to give the patients this intense chemotherapy. But you know that there's really good 70 and 80 year olds, and there's really poor 50 year olds. So we don't use age so much as a criteria, we use performance status. And then AML, secondary to prior chemotherapy or bone marrow issue, is going to be harder to treat with less chance of remission, and if the white count is greater than 20,000. So again, signs and symptoms of bone marrow failure. Now, in acute myelogenous leukemia, we have a few different ones. So hyperleukocytosis with a white count of greater than 100,000 leads to leukostasis, and so we have hypoxia, especially in the lungs. Then there could be coagulation issues, so abnormal platelet function and increased risk of DIC. So DIC is most commonly seen in M3, which is acute promyelocytic leukemia. So if you think about the maturation process as it's going from M2 to M3, that's where you start getting your granulocytes in there. So if you have lysis of those cells, you're releasing all those granules and increasing your risk of triggering that clotting cascade. So those patients need to be prophylactically treated, usually with heparin. And then tophilitis mimics appendicitis, and that's an inflammation of the cecum. There's metabolic issues, so tumor lysis syndrome can be an issue. If you have a really high white count, these patients need to be prophylaxed for tumor lysis syndrome prior to starting chemotherapy. Renal tubular dysfunction, you think about these large cells trying to get through the tiny capillaries in the kidney. And then extramedullary, so granulocytic sarcoma, most likely seen in M5, which is acute monocytic leukemia. So it's skin involvement, gingiva involvement. And it's not as common to see lymph nodes or splenomegaly. They get CNS issues. So this is a granulocytic sarcoma. They have infiltration of the skin. I had a patient last week that had something similar like this over the knees, and he's been having an undefined bone marrow issue, and I was really concerned this was a sign he was going into acute leukemia. And so the surgeons biopsied, it turned out it was a bizarre infection. So laboratory features, again, anemia almost and thrombocytopenia usually present. The interesting thing in this is some of the patients can actually have a low white count at the time of their diagnosis, and rarely they may have a very high white count. Only less than 10% have the hour rods, and these are cute little rods that you see in the bone marrow, but you're not going to see it on everybody. So you'll see blasts. Again, you have to distinguish them from ALL. Decrease in the normal blood cell progenitors. You need cytogenetics to help identify what kind of leukemia you have, and the immunophenotyping with flow cytometry. So that helps distinguish it between ALL, and the characteristic CD13 and 33 is usually seen. You can also have some lymphoid markers as well. So the biggest deal with this is you need to have full service on this patient when you're treating them in the hospital. They have to have their medical issues stabilized. They may not be able to eat while they're there, so you may need to have GI. They may develop diarrhea. They may develop infections, so it's infectious disease. So it takes a whole team to help treat these patients. They'll need supportive care with appropriate blood product transfusion, possibly broad spectrum antibiotics or antifungals, antivirals, and the nutrition. So the chemotherapy is pretty standard and has been for decades with the 7+3 regimen. You have 7 days of continuous fusion ARA-C and 3 days of bolus daunorubicin, and you'll get a complete remission in about 60 to 80%. And then they'll need some consolidation, evaluation for possible stem cell transplant. And if they've got acute pro-lymphocytic leukemia, you add ATRA, which is all trans-retinoic acid. So we'll quickly move over to chronic leukemia. We'll start with chronic lymphocytic leukemia. So this is where you see a rise in the lymphocytes of greater than 5,000. You may have bone marrow involvement at least 30%, less than 55% atypical immature lymphoid cells, and a clonal expansion of B lymphocytes. When we do a flow cytometry, the classic is CD5, 19, 20, and 23. So this is usually found incidentally, like most chronic leukemias are, found on routine lab. Patient came in for their yearly physical, and you just start seeing this change, slight increase in their lymphocyte count. And they're usually asymptomatic for long periods of time. You can then get progressive bone marrow failure if it progresses. Many of the people never progress to need treatment. They may stay with a lymphocyte count in the 30, 40,000 range, and just you follow them with observation. However, if they have progressive bone marrow infiltration, then they have inhibition of the other cell lines from producing, so you'll develop a neutropenia, possibly a thrombocytopenia. Their plasma cells aren't working properly, so you may have decrease in your gamma globulins, and you can develop autoimmune phenomenon and Richter's transformation. The autoimmune phenomenon can be hemolytic anemia, ITP, pure red cell hyperplasia, aplasia, and granulocytopenia. This is the classic RHI staging. This is really the only malignancy that has a stage zero. That's probably arguable, but that's just lymphocytosis alone. And so remember, the reason we stage patients is prognosis. And so they generally have a more than 12-year survival time. Then if they develop adenopathy, that's stage one. If they have no adenopathy but have splenomegaly due to the CLL, they would still be considered a stage two. Or if they had anemia and none of the above, they'd still be considered stage three. But that's really uncommon. But you can see once you get down to the progressive anemia with a hemoglobin declining below 10 and a platelet count declining below 100,000, then their survival is shortened. So there's poor prognosis. Advanced stage, of course, as you think about that, short lymphocyte doubling time, diffuse pattern of bone marrow infiltration, so a 17p or 11q deletion, and then this unusual thing, the CLL-PLL, that's pro-lymphocytic leukemia in the chronic phase, and then Richter syndrome, which is transformation to a higher grade of lymphoproliferative disease. Is generally considered incurable, so that's why observation is appropriate. When you think about these patients, the clone of lymphocytes that they're making is malignant, it's not working right, and so if you start treatment early, you're suppressing their neutrophils, you're suppressing their plasma cells from working as well as they should, and so they found that early intervention, even in young people, the mortality was sooner than if they just waited until appropriate reason to treat. So these are indications for treatment. If they have intolerable B symptoms, progressive signs of bone marrow failure with that platelet count dropping below 100,000, the anemia progressing below 10, massive splenomegaly causing early satiety, massive lymphadenopathy, progressive lymphocytosis, Richter's syndrome, hemolytic anemia or ITP. So some of the treatment you may see are the ones listed here. The most common one right now is the bendamustine and the Rituxan. And if they have that 11Q or 17P mutation, then they would be on one of these other medications. So hairy cell leukemia is kind of rare, but I've had two in the past year. Even though it's strong male predominance and older, both these people have been younger and one was a female. So they present with pancytopenia and splenomegaly. So if you have a patient with those two things, put that in your differential diagnosis. And usually their bone marrow is so packed that when you try to get an aspirate, you just get a dry tap. So these are beautiful cells. The left is what you see under a light microscope, but you may not see those hairy projections so well. But under my electron microscope, you see these beautiful wavy ruffles on the cell surface. So usually they're TRAP positive, and you treat these with either cladribine or pentostatin, and most of them will achieve a remission. Chronic myelogenous leukemia, I'll try to get through this in the next few minutes. So this is the one, the hallmark is the Philadelphia chromosome, but only 95% of these patients may have this, as well as when they drill down further, find the BCR-ABL molecular change. So 85% are usually in the chronic phase at the time of diagnosis. Usually the only symptoms they may have some vague fullness because of enlarged spleen or sometimes an enlarged liver, and they may have some unusual infections. I had one patient who was a young male who had recurrent urinary tract infections, and after about the third or fourth one, the family doctor did a CBC and found that his white count was over 400,000. So this is a little cartoon showing you the chromosome, Philadelphia chromosome, with that BCR-ABL transmutation. So it's mostly seen in CML, but it can also be seen in your other leukemias as well, but not as common. And so the chronic phase, if untreated, can last 3 to 5 years. Then it moves into the accelerated phase, which is harder to treat. And then the blastic phase. And this was before we had the development of the medications we have now. So usual workup with lab work and a bone marrow biopsy, and very important to get the cytogenetics. So current treatment is the imatinib, which is Gleevec, or nilotinib, or dasatinib. And then when we have failure of those, we do have backup. It used to be stem cell transplant. 30 years ago was offered to these patients routinely if they're under the age of 30. But now with these other medications, we can often have them in a remission for 5, 6, 8 years. And when that one fails, we have another one to turn to.